I tuck it into my trousers and button my cardigan over it before going downstairs. Carla has arrived and is making a pot of tea. "Thank you, Polly," I say, but she doesn't seem to hear. "The bath is filthy," she says, as I come into the kitchen. "And there's a big lot of dirt on the lawn. What have you been doing?" I wince at the question. Why is it I can remember the garden and the soil and the dew, but none of the reasons for being there? I work the sleeve of my cardigan down over my fingers, picturing the pale gold sky, the sparkling grey of the leaves, colourless until the light hit them. I can see it all perfectly. I just can't think when it was. One of those nights spent waiting for Suki to come home. Some point in the past, anyway. I never wake up in time for the dawn now. "Although it's just as likely to be a son," Carla says. I've missed some earlier part of her speech, and I don't know what she's talking about. "You're lucky to have a daughter. They say sons steal from their old mothers. It was a report I saw on the news." "But I do have a son," I say. "Millions of pounds stolen every year." "I don't have millions of pounds," I say. "And all kinds of antiques, Georgian, Victorian." "I don't have any antiques either." "Oh, this is no good. What sort of a conversation consists of people saying whether they have something or not?" I stop listening, stop answering, but an image shimmers in the air of bookcases and lamps and empty plant pots piled up at a window, of deep-grained solid furniture and dainty silver ornaments, of dark glazed vases and plates made to look as if worms were wriggling across them. The sort of things Elizabeth is always looking for. They didn't used to be so sought after, not when I was a girl, and people sold them off for next to nothing. There were none of these dim, expensive shops or excitable TV programs. The only place I ever saw real antiques was at Frank's. He had hundreds jumbled into his house, and they were always being moved, so that just as you got used to swerving to avoid a chest of drawers, it would disappear, to be replaced by a set of nesting tables put down exactly where you were likely to trip over them. Altogether, the house felt like some sort of nasty trick. A trap. Suki didn't like it either, and some of the things made her afraid, though she only admitted to that once. I tripped over a revolving bookcase and bashed my knee on a grumpy-looking grandfather clock on my way to the sitting room. Suki was curled up on a high-backed sofa, drawing a needle slowly through some delicate bluish material, strands of her hair catching on the sofa back, looking like creepers growing up a wall. Ma had sent me round with rags and darning wool, convinced that my sister wouldn't be coping with all the housework. But Suki never seemed to need much help. So I sat down by the fire and warmed one side of my face until it was burning hot. Frank's removal men were unloading a van in the yard, and they came through the sitting room on their way to the cellar, carrying boxes, spindly little tables and heavy dining chairs. Suki nodded at them as they emerged empty-handed, trying to rid their lungs of the dank cellar air. "Old woman from the avenues died," she said. "So Frank's bought more junk. Much good it'll do us. Though it might come in handy for firewood, I suppose." She said the last bit loudly, and a soft-faced, sweating removal man stopped on his way to the cellar with one of the sharp-legged tables. "If that's what you're going to use it for, I'll break it up now. Save me a trip to yonder hell pit," he said, putting the table down and leaning on it. Suki smiled at her sewing, lifting one shoulder very carefully so as not to disturb the perfect line of stitches, and the man picked up his table again, chuckling to himself. She looked at me when he was gone. "Oh, mops," she said, "but just look on the mantelpiece. See what Frank's keeping for himself from the house clearance. Ghoulish, I call it. Suki often complained about the junk that Frank brought home. Paintings of boats all done in brownish paint and ugly plates teeming with insects. This time it was a glass dome the size of a coal bucket full of stuffed birds. I got up, pressing a hand to the fiery side of my face, and peered in. The birds were brightly coloured, green and yellow and blue. Some had their wings spread out, some had beaks poking into flowers. Others, as I moved round, pointed straight at me. Their glassy eyes seemed not to fit quite in their sockets, and their feathers had a dullness to them which made me think they'd been dyed. I couldn't look away. Horrid, aren't they? For some reason, Frank's taken a liking to them, and so we're to have them here from now on. And Mops, no matter how many times I say to myself, "They're stuffed and dead, Suki, get a hold of yourself," I still can't shake the idea that they're going to fly out at me. She pulled her row of stitches straight. Silly, isn't it? I looked at her and nodded, and that made her laugh. But I can just hear it, Mops. The glass breaking, and the blighters fluttering out, flapping their wings, coming to peck my eyes out.
Blimey, your missus has a mind on her,
one of the men said, coming into the room with Frank. They carried an old sofa between them.
You want to watch she doesn't come up with too many ideas about you?
Well, that's just where I'm lucky, Alf, Frank said. She's managed to get the idea into her head that I'm a catch, and I'm not complaining.
They took the sofa into the cellar, and Suki watched them disappear down the steps before turning to me. Get my shawl to cover those birds, will you? She said. I can joke all I like, but I really can't bear to see them any longer. She looked quite desperate, and I went off to find the shawl, which she thought she'd left on a chair in the kitchen, or on the coat stand in the hall, or possibly in the bedroom wardrobe. And if not there, then definitely on the towel rack in the bathroom. I walked through the kitchen, trying my hardest not to trip over or scrape my skin or knock my elbows, and had to hold the door open for two men carrying a large piece of furniture in from the yard. It was covered by a cloth, but I guessed it was a dressing table from the shape, with a mirror fixed to the top. The edges of the cloth rippled with the movement, and made it seem as if the dressing table was floating between the men's hands. One of them, a man with a face full of vertical lines, asked me to open the next door for them. I ran over to do it, but forgetting it opened outwards, pulled instead of pushed, banging the door in its frame and making the plates on the nearest dresser clink together alarmingly. The men laughed.
You haven't quite got your sister's delicate touch, have you?
The line-faced one said. They floated the furniture into the sitting room, and I started up the stairs, stopping halfway and breathing quietly, listening to the house. There were creaks, deep and almost human, as if the house was straining under the weight of other people's possessions. These were covered by the dissonant chiming of two clocks somewhere downstairs, and once I heard the cursing of a removal man as he walked into or fell over some piece of furniture. I hoped it was the line-faced one, and looked out of the window. There was no one in the yard now, and yet I could hear a faint rustling from outside, the sort of sound a blackbird makes when it's foraging for worms under a hedge. A short, angry fizz of foliage, followed by another. I couldn't see anything, but the thicket near the lane bristled, and for some reason the sight of it made me shiver. There was no wind that day, and everything else was still, but I'd seen birds shake the hedgerows before, rearranging their wings inside them. Why should it frighten me now? I carried on to the landing, nearly falling over an elephant foot umbrella stand, and squeezing through an army of old gramophones, their horns like summer squash flowers.
None of these would play, but Frank kept them because if you stripped out the insides, you could keep all sorts of things in them. Suki told us that over dinner one evening, and Dad made muttered suggestions that the things wouldn't be legal, guessing the contents based on the gifts Frank had given us. Ham, nylons, marmalade, dried fruit, butter, eggs. The list had made Ma very cheerful indeed, though she'd been careful not to let Dad see. Suki's shawl was on the towel rack, and as I pulled it free, I caught sight of myself in the bathroom mirror. I was surprised to meet myself there and surprised by the way I looked. My face wasn't the barrier I thought it was. It seemed so unguarded, so easy to read, so open to misinterpretation. My eyes were ringed with darkish circles before I ever lost an hour of sleep, and my lips were red, as if I'd been biting them in agitation. My nose was shiny, too. Suki had promised to teach me to use powders several months before, and I reminded her as I went back into the sitting room. "I don't know, Mops," she said. "Perhaps you're too young. Perhaps I shouldn't have promised. Dad'll probably have a fit." I was about to protest when I hit the peak of my ankle on a low tea table and I squealed instead, lifting my foot. The lion-faced man came in and laughed.
"Clumsy one, you, eh?"
Flustered and irritated, I tossed the shawl at Suki, thinking she would catch it. But she wouldn't take her hands from her sewing, and it sailed onto her head, draping her, shroud-like. She cried out as she stabbed herself with her needle. "It's to cover the birds," she said, drawing the material off and pushing her hair back from her face. "Not me." "Sorry," I said, stepping quickly over an empty iron plant pot holder, wanting just to get out of the house. "Mops," Suki called after me. "Mops." I carried on to the yard, the clear path and the cooler air already making me feel better. I got to the side of the house and stopped, stretching my limbs in the uncluttered space, and heard that rustling in the hedge, that blackbirdish noise, and again felt the inexplicable shiver of dread. Suki had drawn up a window, and I turned away as she leant out. "Oh, get away, get away! Why are you always here? I can't bear it." I thought for a moment she meant me and had told her to go and boil her head before I saw she was facing the hedge. As I looked, I was able to make out a woman standing, her lower body pressed to the other side of the fence, one arm deep in the foliage. The other was bent at the elbow so that she could press something against her mouth. Or into her mouth, I thought, as I saw her jaw work. The thicket was made of small hawthorn trees, and the woman seemed to have a fistful of leaves which she was chewing. She stared at Suki as she chewed, not in the least bothered by her discovery, and Suki stared back, horrified. Of course I knew who it was. Everyone knew the mad woman. "We need Doug," Suki said. "Doug? You mean Frank?" I said, and called for him. When he came out, shouting and threatening and raising his fist, I went back inside to Suki. She laughed off her fright, saying the woman must be some sort of gourmet. "I mean, I don't blame her," she said. "Hawthorn's delicious, isn't it, Mops? Remember we used to call it bread and cheese?" I nodded, but I didn't like the brittle tone to her voice. "We used to prefer it to Ma's sandwiches, remember? Better than meat paste, better than carrots simmered in beef tea." She paused, like a moment in a film, one hand on her hip. And then she suddenly sagged against the mantelpiece. "But Mops, there must be hawthorns enough in the park. So why here? Why does she have to come here?" She looked at herself in the mirror above the fireplace,
her eyes studiously avoiding the newly veiled glass dome of birds. And then she raised her hand up until it covered her mouth, reminding me for one awful moment of the position of the madwoman.
Carla has suggested I try church. She's a Catholic and thinks it might be a comfort in some way. I've surrendered and let her give me a lift to a service this morning on her way to another old crone. I insisted on an Anglican church, though I don't really believe in any particular god, and I'm not sure what to expect. Ma stopped going to Holy Communion after Suki went missing, and I never restarted the habit. Patrick didn't believe in anything either, and Helen's quite a determined atheist. But lots of old people go to church. Elizabeth does. The church she goes to is an ancient stony building with comically serene-faced martyrs in the stained glass. Everyone in the congregation is a bit dressed up. Or they've made some effort anyway, winding silk scarves around their necks or sliding sparkly things into their hair. I feel rather drab and shy for a few minutes. But then I remember that I am old and nobody's looking at me. I take my hymn book and sit down. "Hymns, ancient and modern," I read. A couple of people turn to look at me. There can't be more than a dozen people here. The smell of wood and polish reminds me of school. It's quite comforting, as is all the shined brass and flower arrangements. I start to understand why the elderly go to church. There are flowers on the end of each pew, and I reach a hand out to brush the petals in the nearest arrangement. One of the flower heads comes away, and I close my fist around it. The action is familiar, and I repeat it, opening my hand before crushing the flower again. But I can't think what it means, and anyway, it's the wrong sort of flower. It should be a yellow summer squash flower, and these ones are white, as if left over from a wedding. Perhaps someone got married yesterday. Young people still do that in church, I'm told. I squeeze my fist while the vicar clears his throat, and people on other benches bow their heads in prayer. The petals of the flower are soft and crushable. I like it like this, mangled and real, rather than stiffly sitting in its arrangement. These bunches on the pews are too much like those you find preserved under Victorian glass domes, crisp and dry, and slightly unnerving. We stand and sing and sit and pray. I'd forgotten how tiring these services could be. I can't keep up, and I lose track of where we are, so I just mime along with everything. The vicar looks puzzled when he sees me moving my mouth during his talk, his speech from the pulpit. Finally, it's time for tea. There's a huge metal urn on the trolley at the back of the church, and lots of greenish cups, far too many for the number of people. A woman in a padded body warmer, the same colour as the cups, comes towards me with a tin of biscuits. "We haven't seen you before," she says. "No," I say. And then I go blank. I can't think where I am, or why. I wobble slightly on the flagstones and my breath catches. I take two biscuits from the tin, balancing them on my saucer. "Are you local or visiting?" she asks. "I don't know," I say, feeling foolish and panicky. "I mean, where are we, exactly?" She smiles. It's a kind smile, but it's full of embarrassment. "This is St. Andrew's." The name means nothing. I don't like to ask any more. "Perhaps you usually go to the chapel," she suggests. "There's one just a couple of streets away." I shake my head. I haven't forgotten my religion. I know I'm not a Wesleyan or Baptist or anything. I'm not even really a Christian. "Sorry," I say. "I'm a bit forgetful." The woman looks as though she thinks this description doesn't quite cover it, but she nods and takes a sip of tea before introducing me to the vicar. Luckily, I have been practicing my name in my head.
"How do you do?" the vicar says, shaking my hand.
His hands are incredibly soft, as if they've been worn smooth by the amount of handshaking he has to do.
"I hope you enjoyed the service."
I wasn't aware that it was the sort of thing he was supposed to enjoy, so the question rather takes me by surprise. "Oh," I say. He and the woman in the body warmer start to move away, frightened off by my inarticulacy. And I look down at my tea and biscuits, uncertain what to do with them. I watch as a man takes two sugar lumps from his saucer, drops them into his tea, and stirs. And with a sigh of relief, I do the same with my biscuits, stirring the pulpy mixture round and round. When I look up, everyone in the little group of people is staring at me, except the woman in the body warmer, whose eyes are fixed on the ceiling. She nudges the man next to her, and he coughs.
"No, she wasn't well at all," he says. "It was Rod who found out about it. He used to pick her up, didn't you, Rod?"
A small man with a comb-over nods.
"Yes, that's right," he says. "So naturally, her son rang me. I told him we'd pray for her."
"Of course, of course.
Actually, I'd been to the house several times needlessly before I got a call. Rather annoying. Stood outside waiting, and no answer."
"Elizabeth," I say suddenly. I hadn't meant to. The woman in the body warmer looks at me finally. "Elizabeth," I say again. "She's missing."
"Yes, that's right, dear. She is missing from our congregation.
Never mind." She turns to the others. I bite my lip in humiliation. But I must catch at the chance before I forget. "No," I say. "I've been looking for her. She isn't at home."
"Not at your home?"
the woman asks, careful with each syllable.
"She really is very irritating."
I suppress the urge to scream. "No, no, she's a friend of mine. She's gone missing." The comb-over man frowns and smooths a hand over his head. The long, thin hairs seem to be embedded in his scalp.
"She's not missing."
"Where is she, then?" I ask. "I've been to her house."
"Well, dear," the woman says, looking at the group, "perhaps it was the wrong house."
Her voice is quiet, as if she doesn't want anyone to hear her suggestion. But her words are very clear, and they are listening closely. The vicar coughs and shifts his feet, and the other man smooths his head again. Her tone is final, and I can already feel the conversation moving on. In a moment, someone will mention the weather. I get a flash of heat. How dare they dismiss me, these people who are supposed to care about Elizabeth? How dare they? "I didn't go to the wrong house," I say quietly, steadily, the assertion making me feel like a small child. "I'm not stupid. Elizabeth is missing." I take a shuddering breath in the silence. "Why don't you care? Why won't anyone do anything?" I think I'm beginning to shout, but I can't help it. "Anything could have happened to her. Anything. Why will no one do a thing to help find her?" Frustration constricts my breathing. I squeeze the cup in my hand and then throw it at the ground. It smashes easily on the stone floor of the church, and the sound rings through the building as the syrupy, crumb-filled tea soaks into the mortar between the flagstones. The woman in the body warmer puts down her cup and picks up the broken remains of mine.
"Perhaps I'd better take you home," she says.
She leads me gently away from the vicar and puts me in her car. "And
She is very patient when I give her the wrong directions to my house and we have to go round the one-way system a second time. As she drives along, I write a note to myself. Elizabeth, not at church. The woman sees me writing it and reaches over to pat my hand.
I shouldn't worry if I were you, dear, she says, as she helps me out of the car. God looks after his flock. You must look after yourself.
She offers to collect me for church next Sunday, but I tell her I'm not really up to it. She nods in understanding, and there is a touch of relief in her smile. Chapter 6 The police station is still in its original building. The stone front with 1887 carved above the door and the big glass hallway lantern are somehow reassuring. But the floor inside looks as though it's wet, and I'm not sure about stepping on it. I stand for a moment at the threshold, wondering how drunk and disorderlies manage on the slippery surface. And I put a hand against the wall when I go in, keeping to it as I walk round. After a few steps, I find I'm leaning on a notice board. I stop and read out the words of a poster pinned in the middle. Cash machine criminals operate 24 hours a day. I wonder what a cash machine criminal is, and how they manage to stay awake for so long. The thought makes me feel tired. There's a wooden thing for sitting. A long wooden seat next to me. But I can't sit down. I must keep on. I must do the thing I came to do. For a moment I can't think what it is. My mind is blank. My arm starts to shake and my heart beats in my stomach. I take a deep breath and put a hand into the pocket of my cardigan, looking for a note. I must have written it down, whatever it was. There must be a reminder somewhere. I pull out lots of coloured squares of paper, the edges curling against the skin between my thumb and forefinger. I don't like having to take my other hand away from the wall to shuffle through them. I don't feel I can trust my balance. I find a pink square with today's date. If it is today's date, I'm not sure. And a yellow square with my daughter's telephone number on it, in case of emergencies. There's a recipe for vegetable soup, though most of it seems to be missing, and the ingredients list stops at onions. But I can't see anything to tell me why I'm here.
Hello, Mrs. Horsham, a voice says.
I look up. There's a desk on the other side of the room with a sign saying Police Reception. I read it aloud. A man is behind the desk, but I can only just see him through the shine on the glass divide. I push the notes back into my pocket and walk past a bench, worn and wooden. Is that where they put the newly arrested people, I wonder? Is this place full of drunks and prostitutes and street thieves at night? Doesn't seem possible. Now, in the middle of the day, it's all quiet, and I can hear the echo of my footsteps as I walk towards the desk. When I get closer, I can make out the dark epaulets, like tiny wings, on the man's white shirt. He smiles up from his computer screen, and I find myself smiling back, the way I used to with Frank, the muscles around my lips automatically obeying his. I can't think how he knows my name.
Same as usual,
he says, his voice sounding metallic through the speakers. Usual, I say.
Elizabeth, is it?
He nods, as if encouraging me to say a line in a play. Elizabeth, yes, I say, amazed. Of course that's what I've come for. I've come for her. Do you know about Elizabeth? I ask, feeling a rush of relief. Perhaps someone is investigating after all. Someone is looking for her. Someone knows about her disappearance. A weight lifts from my shoulders. How long have I been struggling to make anyone listen?
Oh, yes, I know all about Elizabeth, he says.
Tears of relief come into my eyes and I smile through them.
Missing, right?
I nod.
Probably that no-good son of hers, don't you think?
I move my shoulders in helpless agreement.
And no one else seems to think she's missing. That it?
That's it exactly, officer, I say, clinging onto the counter.
Thought it might be.
He grins at me for a couple of seconds. I have a sinking feeling.
This'll be the... let me see.
He clicks at the computer a few times.
The fourth time you've been in.
Fourth time? So, I say, is someone looking for Elizabeth already then? I know as soon as the words are out of my mouth that it's hopeless. He laughs.
Oh, yeah, I've got every man on the force out. Sniffer dogs, forensics, flying squad. They're all out there.
He pauses to skim a hand through the air.
Looking for your friend Elizabeth.
I go hot at his words. My armpits prickle. I can see what he thinks of me now, and I feel sick. The tears spill over finally, and I turn away so he won't see them.
Forget the drug dealers and the rapists and the murderers, I told the team, the policeman says. What about that no-good son of old Lizzie?
I don't hear any more, because I'm hurrying out of the building and into the street. The cooler air catches at the wet patches on my cheeks. I stand by the bus stop and cover my mouth with the sleeve of my cardigan. This was a last hope. If the police won't take me seriously, what chance is there of ever seeing Elizabeth again? I don't remember going to the police station about my sister. Dad went on his own to report her missing, and again after we'd spoken to her neighbours. He and Ma went often after that to find out what was being done, what might have been discovered, but they never took me with them. I do remember a policeman coming to the house, though, to ask us about Suki. He was there when I got home from school.
I did say I'd pop in, he said,
sitting at our kitchen table, the plate in front of him loaded with slices of cake. He had shiny brown hair and dark shadows under his eyes. And he wasn't in uniform.
But this screaming business seems to be totally unrelated. Happened weeks and weeks ago, according to the neighbours. I had a constable check. And it's like they told you at the station. People are being reported missing left, right and centre nowadays. The men can't get used to being back on Civvy Street, or the women can't get used to having their husbands home again, and so they're off. And we get the poor abandoned folk crying to us.
But Frank was always home, Ma said, putting the teapot down and sliding onto the chair next to me.
Eh? Didn't fight?
The policeman looked up from his cake, a crumb falling from the corner of his mouth.
Runs a removal firm, Gerard's,
Dad said, looking at the crumb where it lay on the table.
Reserved occupation. And anyway, Frank's gone missing too.
The policeman nodded slowly.
Oh, yes, yes, that's right. Gerard's, I know it. He helped my aunt move a few things after she was bombed, matter of fact.
It was that air raid over the school. Do you remember that one?
Yes, he did us a real favour there.
Still, he cleared his throat and pressed a few stray currants together with his fingers.
I knew he'd gone, 'cause he's wanted for questioning.
Is he? Dad asked. The policeman gestured with fingers still pinched around the currants.
Coupon fraud,
he said, putting the dried fruit into his mouth.
A serious business. It's helping people to more than their fair share. And that, in turn, encourages others to buy things on the black market.
Ma cut more slices off the cake and refilled his cup of tea.
Black market, eh? Something else I imagine Frank knows all about. So you haven't found him?
Dad said.
No.
and that does put another spin on things, him being wanted.
He took a slurp of tea.
I suppose they might have decided to do a runner together. You said something about him having a suitcase.
Dad leaned away from the table and put his hands into his pockets, gazing at the ground.
I really can't believe that Suki would have gone along with anything criminal, he said.
I kept my eyes lowered and fiddled with the handle of my cup, remembering Suki's fur collars and new snakeskin bag, the boxes of British Army rations in the old stables, and all the extra food we had for dinner whenever she and Frank came round.
Well, no, it would hardly be worth running anyway, the policeman said, reaching for another bit of cake. There's not much of a case, if I'm honest. But if it's not that, then...
Then Frank's done something to her and made a break for it, Dad said.
Frank never would, Ma said, jumping up and throwing her teaspoon into the sink. Dad lifted his head to look at her. I must have caught sight of Douglas in the hallway because he called his name.
This is Sergeant Needham, Douglas. Come about Suki. Sergeant, this is our lodger.
Douglas stepped down into the kitchen, leaning awkwardly against the shelves by the door. He nodded at the sergeant and then shook his head when Ma offered him some tea.
Did I hear you talking about Frank? He said, turning his head sideways and tugging at the hem of his pullover. Yes, said the sergeant. Mrs. Palmer here doesn't think he can have anything to do with her daughter's disappearance. Doesn't she?
Douglas asked, looking at Ma where she stood still facing the sink.
Well, I do. He's a jealous man, is Frank. Got a temper on him, too.
Jealous, is he? Said the sergeant.
Why's that, then? Anything to do with you, is it?
No,
Douglas said, pronouncing the short word slowly and carefully.
But Suki's told me he can be jealous.
Douglas kept his eyes fixed on the sergeant. His face seemed stiff like a mask, and I had the mad idea that when he spoke, he did it without moving his lips.
Jumps to the wrong conclusions, she's said.
Dad took his hands out of his pockets and rubbed them over his face, and Ma turned and leant back against the sink, gripping the edge behind her. I wondered why Suki would tell Douglas anything, and why she hadn't told me.
I wondered if it was true.
When did Suki say that?
I asked, not meaning to. Immediately Dad told me I should go upstairs. This is no discussion for you, he said.
I left the table but lingered at the top of the steps up to the hallway. The kitchen looked cosy and bright, the light from the range competing with the overhead lamp. I could almost believe it was a normal family tea, with the cups out and the teapot steaming. Except, of course, there was a policeman in Ma's usual place, finishing off the cake and writing things down in a little book.
Yes, when did she tell you that?
He asked Douglas, turning a page of the notebook.
Lots of times. She told me lots of times, Sergeant, he said. Over the summer.
I could only see a section of him from the chest down, but his arm moved, and I guessed he'd shrugged.
What? When she came for dinner?
Ma asked, her legs still visible against the cupboard under the sink.
I never heard her.
Douglas's pink jaw jutted out below the top of the door frame as he bent forward, and I thought he was going to say something. But the sergeant swallowed the last dregs of his tea and scraped back his chair.
Time I was off, he said.
He pushed his cup away, wrote something in his notebook, and stood up.
Thanks for the tea, Mrs. Palmer. I will let you know if anything presents itself. But don't worry, people are moving around all the time at the moment. Can't keep still. More than likely they've gone off to try another town for a bit, and we'll be back when they realise everywhere's the same. Anyway, the law'll catch up with Frank before long.
He stood on the spot for a few more seconds, facing Douglas, before following Dad to the front door. I moved quickly into the sitting room and heard Ma say something to Douglas about not having any cake left. That was the last of the dried fruit Frank got for me, she said. and I imagined the face Douglas would make at the mention of him. "How was your film?" she asked, changing the subject before he could start on Suki's marriage. There was a murmured answer, too low to catch. "What?" Ma said. "I thought that one was supposed to be funny. Weren't you paying attention?" Meanwhile, Dad was thanking Sergeant Needham for coming.
"Not a problem. I'll let you know if Gerard turns up, or that suitcase he was carrying."
They stopped at the door to look back down the hall and allow the sergeant time to brush the crumbs from his trousers.
"That boy reminds me of someone," I heard him say as he left. "Just can't think who."
I've chucked all the notes on Elizabeth into the waste paper basket. It looks like a tub of confetti. I feel terrible abandoning her like this, but what can I do? There's nothing to go on, as they say, and no one who can help. I have been to the police station 4 times. I know, because I have it written down. 4 times, and they will do nothing. They think I'm a dotty old woman. I think they might be right. I look out a big sheet of paper and a red pen, and I make a notice to put on my sitting room wall. Elizabeth is not missing. Even if I don't believe it now, I might in a few hours. Sooner, perhaps. I don't want to be drawn back into looking for her. It's useless. No one will believe me, and I'll only drive myself mad if I carry on. Anyway, there's so much I can't remember. Perhaps I have got it completely wrong. Perhaps Elizabeth is at home, and I've been fussing over nothing. Carla sees the notice when she arrives and nods approvingly. "Quite right," she says. "You concentrate on keeping safe and well. Better safe than sorry, eh?" She bustles about as usual, telling me of muggings and armed robberies. I try to keep up, but I feel it doesn't really relate to me any more. "The elderly are just as bad with safety," she is saying. "They don't see their locks are turned properly, or their windows are shut tight. It's because you grew up in a different time. I bet you knew everyone then, huh?" "Don't be daft," I say. "The town was full of all sorts when I was a girl. Men just demobbed, getting drunk in the pubs. American and Canadian soldiers waiting to go home. Evacuees from London or Birmingham with no home to go back to. And convalescents, hoping for a cure from the sea air." Carla disappears upstairs to do my bedroom before I can finish the thought, and I wander into the kitchen. My sandwich hasn't been made yet, so I put some bread in the bread heater, the bread browner, and get out the butter. "How much toast you think you eat?" Carla says, suddenly reappearing. "You must get through a loaf a day." "Well, there's no cake left because of the sergeant," I say. "If there's no cake, it's because you've had it," she says, running the tap and whisking fairy liquid into a mountain of foam. I don't much like her tone. I move out of her way and check the front door before going to sit down. Carla comes into the sitting room to give me my pills. I don't know what they're for. "And then, of course, there's the key safes," she says, as she stands by the coffee table writing in the carer's folder. "You have to have them so us care workers can get in and that. But it would only take one bad lot, wouldn't it? Someone tells someone the code, and the criminal doesn't even have to break in." She puts her hands to her head and then lifts them into the air. "They can't be that dangerous," I say, "or they wouldn't make everyone have them. Even Elizabeth has one."
My mind rushes to tell me something. Elizabeth has a key safe. Key safes make it easy to get into a house. I write it down and put Elizabeth's name next to it.
"Elizabeth has a key safe," I say again. "If someone had got in..."
"Not that again," Carla says.
"I thought you'd given it up."
She points to the sign on the wall.
"Oh,
Yes, I say, laying down my pen. I feel disappointed, as if I've lost something valuable. Okay, bye. She goes to the door. There is the sound of her trying to open it. It bangs as if it's stuck. Hey, she calls. You've locked it. Where's the key? I get up and show her the little pot on the radiator shelf where I keep it. You said to check the locks, I say, showing Carla the note I wrote on the subject. She stares at me. But you don't check them while I'm still here. When she's locked me in again, I go and look for my sandwich. There's a piece of toast on the sideboard, and I put down my handful of notes to get the butter. But I can't find any in the fridge. There's a big sign above the stove telling me not to cook anything, but I really fancy an egg with my toast. Surely boiling an egg is allowed? That's hardly cooking at all. I turn on the gas and fill a saucepan with water. While I'm waiting for it to boil, I pick up my notes to read. Key safes make it easy to get into a house. Elizabeth's name is next to it. I read it several times. There's something significant about it. I just don't know what. I've also written, would only take one bad lot. But that's true of everything. And anyway, you can't go around being afraid of everyone. You have to let some people into your home. Suki was the one who suggested Douglas as a lodger. She was working in the Naffy canteen, which had been set up in a hotel on the clifftop. And Douglas was doing milk deliveries until he was old enough to join the army. The canteen was on his route, and Suki liked him. They used to chat before she opened in the morning, mostly about films, she said. I met him one day when Suki took me to work. It was the week after our school had been hit in a night raid. They hadn't got the facilities for us to join the boys' school yet, and Ma didn't want me hanging around at home all day. We had to get out really early, and I was still half asleep when we arrived. Suki sat me down in the kitchen while she weighed tea and coffee into white cloth bags and ran backwards and forwards to check the hot water urn. I thought she looked funny in her blue overalls and little cap, but she didn't seem to mind. There was a lovely smell of cooking, and she gave me beans on toast and a sausage to eat. "Shouldn't really," she said as she passed me the plate. Only meant to be for the Yanks. It was mainly American soldiers they served there then, and I kept listening out for an accent as I ate. I was just finishing when I heard one.
Sure thing, it said, and that'll be just fine.
I looked round and saw Suki come in with a boy. He carried a crate of milk bottles and set them on the counter in front of me. I was surprised at seeing an American milkman and stared at him. "This is Doug Mops," Suki said, a hand on his shoulder. "Say hello." "Hello, Doug," I said, looking past him as Suki picked up a couple of milk bottles and went back out of the kitchen.
"Hello, Mops," he said, frowning a little at the name.
His eyes followed Suki as she walked away. I laughed. "That's not my real name, silly," I said. He looked annoyed at that and turned to me.
"What does she call you that for, then?" he said.
His accent was no longer American, and I wondered if Suki knew he'd been pretending. I put the last bit of sausage into my mouth. "It's a nickname," I said, chewing.
"Bit stupid, isn't it?" he said, still frowning.
I shrugged and rested my fork against the side of my plate.
"Bet Doug isn't your real name." "Course it is," he said, his eyes sliding back over to Suki as she came in and dropped another bag of tea onto the scales.
"Isn't it short for Douglas?" His mouth flattened, and he looked down at the milk bottles, pulling them from their crate jerkily. "Isn't it?"
"Yes."
"So Doug is a nickname, then?" He stopped what he was doing and looked at me.
"You've beaten me there," he said.
And he blushed and flicked another look at Suki. I'd embarrassed him, and I felt sorry. Doug's a good name, I said, trying to make it up. I like it. That made him smile, and I felt even more sorry. He was nice-looking, Douglas, with a soft oval face and brown hair and very straight eyebrows. He was tall, but he stooped and ducked his head when he spoke, and he looked at you sideways so people didn't always notice his height. I hope you're being nice to Doug, Suki said, coming over to put the empty bottles down on the table. I nodded, trying to think of something to say. Hey, we saw the madwoman outside, I said, because we had, though only briefly. Hush, Maud, Suki said. Don't call her that. You don't know who she might be. Imagine if Ma did something funny and someone called her mad. And you weren't listening to me. Doug's going to be our new lodger. She ruffled his hair in the way she usually ruffled mine, and he blushed again. Do you want something to eat? She asked him. No, I'd better be getting on, he said. And he quickly filled the crate with empties, carrying them out and waving awkwardly when Suki called cheerio. Has Ma ever done anything funny? I said to Suki, as soon as he'd gone. Course not, silly, she said, gathering up the bottles of milk. You should just be a bit less quick to judge, that's all. Do you like Doug? Ma's been looking for someone to take the room since old Miss Lacey went to her niece. I meant it, though. Be nice. His mum's just died. Bomb dropped on their house. I felt even worse about the nicknames thing then, and I promised I'd be kind to him. I meant it, too. But I thought of the way Suki had ruffled his hair and offered him food, looking after him in the way she looked after me. And I wondered whether I ever stared at her the way Douglas did. There's a funny smell coming from somewhere. I look round the sitting room, pick up a cushion, and sit down on the window seat. I can't see anything. I can't work out where the smell's coming from. I've been digging a whole lot of my notes out of the waste paper basket, wondering how they got there. I've rescued a scratched blue and silver compact lid from the bin, too, so that makes twice it's been dug up. I'm just getting the energy to go and see what's causing that awful smell when Helen walks in. Mum, you've left the gas on, she shouts. I've told you not to use the oven. You could have blown the whole bloody house up. Ooh, you can smell it in here, too. She stands in front of me and leans past to open the window, wafting the air with the curtain. I look at the underside of her chin. It's very soft-looking. Vulnerable. I'm sorry about the nicknames, I say. Her chin folds into itself as she looks down at me. What? No. I don't know, I say. I wonder if she will get me a cup of tea in a minute. But we might not have any milk because I upset the milkman. Oh, everything is so muddled. There is a breeze from the window. It gets me right in the lower back and makes me shiver. Couldn't you smell it? Helen says. I thought I could smell something, yes, I say, pulling a bit of material over my knees for warmth. Sausage and beans and... What did you say it was? Gas. Oh, has there been some kind of leak, then? The material in my lap won't lie flat. I try to smooth it down, tuck it round me, but it keeps moving. When I look up, Helen is still waving the curtain about. The movement makes me blink. No, Mum, she says. You left the oven on. This is why you mustn't cook. I don't cook usually, Helen, I say. There's a sign in the kitchen. I know there's a sign. I wrote it. She drops the curtain and pushes her fingers into her hair. But I can do a boiled egg, I say. No! No, you can't. Mum, this is what I'm saying. She makes her hands into fists, pulling at the roots of her hair.
I can't work out why she's so upset.
Do you understand? You really mustn't try to cook anything. Anything.
All right, I won't, I say, watching her walk about the room. I'll have a bit of cheese or something instead.
Do you promise? She asks. Will you write it down? I nod and take a pen from my handbag. There's a jumble of coloured paper on the table next to me, and I make a note under a list which starts, Compact, Summer Squash. And write on the sign too, Helen says. I'll come with you and help. She puts out a hand, and I hold it to stand up. Somehow I've managed to get the curtain caught in my trousers, and Helen has to untuck it. She walks very close on the way to the kitchen, her fingers covering mine once on the handrail. When we get there, I realize I've left the pen in the sitting room. Helen runs to fetch it. Even eggs, she says, coming back. Write even eggs on the sign. I do as she asks, and then put the pen down.
What does that mean? I ask.
Even eggs?
What does that mean?
Chapter 7.
That old Eric Coates tune is in my head, calling all workers. It spins round and round, getting more manic by the second. Bouncier, louder, more militaristic. I imagine a crazed smile on my face, my arms moving as if they're pulled by strings. I used to feel restless like this when I was a girl. Everyone telling you to get on and help, to work for the war effort, but not giving you anything specific to do. I switch on the TV but can't focus on it, so I potter about the house, tidying up, doing a bit of cleaning, arranging, dusting. I plump the cushions on the sofa and put the books neatly away. I spray polish onto the coffee table and fetch a cloth to rub it with. Carla comes in just as I'm buffing the first smear of spray into a shine. There's a busy bee, she says, taking off her coat. You doing some cleaning? I should write it in your folder. She nods at me, flipping through the pages with her pen poised. But then she turns and makes a little noise. Oh, well, what's going on? She says. Are you going to burn them? Why have you piled all the books into the fireplace? What are you talking about? I say, dropping the cloth. The books are neatly in position. They fit perfectly in the little alcove next to the TV. It looks very nice. And, she says. What are you using to clean the table? A cloth, I say, frowning at her. She seems to be full of silly questions today. No, I don't think it's a cloth. She has the lump of material in her hands ready to straighten it out. When she holds it up, I can see what it is. A skirt. One of Suki's. A skirt of dark brown jersey covered now in matted polish and crumbs. I must have pulled it from the wardrobe in my old room. There are lots of Suki's things in there, things I cut up and adjusted and wore, and things I kept just because I couldn't bear to throw them away. And now I've gone and ruined something. Carla grins. Novel way to use a skirt, she says.
And then she catches my eye and tilts her head to one side.
I'll put it in the washing machine. Not to worry. It'll be as good as new.
When Carla's gone, I find I don't have the patience to sit down. I have a nagging feeling that there's somewhere I'm supposed to be. I put on my coat and walk out. I can't think where I'm going, but that doesn't matter. I'm sure I'm supposed to be somewhere, and I must come to it eventually. A bus goes past as I reach the top of the road. I hope I didn't mean to get on it. If I did, it's too late now anyway. I keep myself steady with a hand on someone's garden wall while I turn to look back down the street. There is moss, wet under my fingers, and I find I'm scratching it off, enjoying the feel of the roots breaking from their hold. A few brightly coloured scraps of paper are dotted along the pavement. They must be mine. My notes. My paper memory. My pockets are stuffed full of lists and memos. For a moment, I can't be bothered to go back and pick these lost ones up. But I bend for the nearest, feeling a creaking in my joints, knowing something critical might be lost if I don't retrieve it. This nearest is a blue square of paper. Charity shop, 2 p.m. today. I still help out there. 2 p.m. today. Does that really mean today? I have a feeling it doesn't, but I wouldn't like to let them down. Those awful images of skinny children with swollen bellies and flies around their mouths would haunt me if I did. And if it's a Tuesday, Elizabeth will be there. I walk to the bus stop, reaching for the nearest scraps of paper as I go. I'm sure these terrible famines didn't happen so much when I was young. I find half a bar of chocolate in the pocket of my coat while I'm waiting, and eat it on the bus. The charity shop is in the arcade. It used to be a posh jeweller's, and it's where my sister got her engagement ring. My old hairdresser is here too, although it's been closed a long while. The windows are dusty, and the old-fashioned hairdryers, which have been left behind, stand, slowly disintegrating, like a row of overgrown harebells in a sandy field. The shop next door sells all sorts of bathroom gifts, salts and oils and bubbles and glass trays for soap and shells dyed different colours. We get quite a lot of their things given into our charity shop. I would have loved the shells when I was young. I had a collection once, and still have some of them stored away at home, in a chest made of glued-together matchboxes. I used to pick them up from the edge of the beach, my parents shouting at me not to get too close to the barbed wire. I like to hold them to my ears and listen to the rush of the waves. I had a lot of pink ones, and some speckled grey. I never got further than that in identification, though. Uncle Trevor gave me a book on shells when he found I was collecting, but I wasn't interested in knowing the names. And as I looked through the pages, the drawings of the horrid slug-like things that had lived in my beautiful collection began to make me feel sick. I didn't like to think of those ugly, slimy things in connection with the pearly, imperfect shells. The word mollusk angered me, and eventually I threw the book away. I am hit by the musty smell as I go into our shop. We can never seem to get rid of it, despite steam cleaning all the donated clothes. The air is stale and sourish. It's the only thing I really dislike about working here. That and Peggy. She looks up from behind the counter as I walk in, her pale, starch, stiff hair catching the light. She's only 68, and so is better than me by a good dozen years. "Maud," she says, "what are you?" "Am I late?" I say, pushing at a rack of clothes so I can get past. "No, Maud, we don't need you. I mean..." She leans her hands on the counter and puts on a high-pitched, wheedling voice. It's the one my daughter uses when she's trying to persuade me that throwing half my possessions away or giving up cooking is for the best. "We decided you weren't to worry about coming back here, didn't we? Do you remember?" I lower my head and pretend to look through the basket of things on the front desk. I feel a sudden welling up of hatred for Peggy as I poke at the soiled leather bookmarks and plastic napkin rings. "I do remember. She and Mavis decided I wasn't up to working here. Well, I was always at a disadvantage. The others had jobs in shops when they were young. Peggy was at Beale's, Mavis managed Carlton Shoes, and Elizabeth's father owned a bakery which she had to serve in as a child. But my dad got me a job at the exchange straight out of school, so I was never anything other than a telephonist. I found the till at the charity shop difficult enough as it was, and then I began to get the different coins confused, giving people too much change. When I was flustered by a customer, it was even worse. One day I stood staring at a pound coin, unable to recognize it. The man at the counter kept sighing.
"You can't be that bad at maths," he said.
I don't know what I gave him in the end, but Peggy was very angry. She taps her varnish-encrusted nails on the counter now, waiting for me to answer. I carry on rummaging through the basket, and my finger catches on the back of a little picture frame. "That's funny," I say, pulling it out. "Elizabeth has a frame like this. It holds a picture of us just after we met. It's unusual, isn't it?" I smooth my thumb over the corner. The frame is made of creamy porcelain with flowers delicately sprouting along both sides. A tiny cherub's head pokes out at the top, looking down at where the photo should be. "I wouldn't have thought there would be two alike," I say. "She bought it from here a few months after she'd started."
"God, yes, she was always buying bits of china. I see you have a good memory for some things, Maud."
"I really think it is her frame. But she would never have given it away." I look up at Peggy. "Was the photo in it?"
"Possibly, but we would hardly have tried to sell it with a photo still inside. Anyway, I doubt very much that it's Elizabeth's frame."
The door opens, and Peggy smiles briefly at someone entering the shop. "You can always give us the £2 for it if you want it. Buying things is the best way for you to help us now." I know what this means. But I'm not ready to leave yet. "Shall I make you a cup of tea?" I say, laying the frame down carefully in the basket. "I can remember where the kettle is, and you're stuck out here." I begin to move towards the back room. Peggy's frown fades. "Well," she says, "well, that would be nice. I'd like an instant coffee." I fill the kettle and switch it on. One thing I do remember about Peggy is that she can't bear to throw photos away. I've always thought that fact made her seem more human. Under the work table, piled high with donated clothes, there's a drawer she keeps the old photos in. The wood squeaks as I pull it out, and I flick a look towards the door, glad the kettle makes such a noise, before sitting down to sift through the pictures. Lots of them are of pets, a couple of family groups, and a few on stiff card from long ago. A man in uniform about to go off to fight in the Great War, and a woman with leg of mutton sleeves standing by a potted palm. I set them aside, searching through several layers of snapshots before I find a highly coloured photo of two ordinary-looking women in soft floral blouses. Elizabeth and me. We are standing just outside the arcade, the painted iron gates curling prettily behind us. Elizabeth's grey-streaked hair is pinned tightly to her head, and mine floats away into the air. We smile at the camera, showing off the wrinkles that prove we are past middle age, and Elizabeth holds something up. It's a frog-shaped jug she bought on her first day at the charity shop.
"Just a replica," she said,
"and hideous, if you ask me. But Elizabeth's hands are holding it as though it were very precious." That was the day we met, the day I found out that her garden was the one with the pebbled wall, the day I decided we'd be friends. I can still remember the way my face ached from laughing. She would never have thrown this picture away. My eyes fill with tears. I'm starting to think she must be dead. The mounds of discarded clothes on the table suddenly take on an ugly significance. All the hours Elizabeth and I spent going through the donations, and I never thought that one day one of us might be going through the things of the other. I put the photo in my pocket, and the kettle pings. I take Peggy's mug to the counter. "Oh, Maud," she calls out as I leave the shop. "I asked for coffee and you've given me tea." I walk back through the park. There's a plank for sitting on, a long sitting plank by the bandstand that looks towards Elizabeth Road, and I have a rest, watching a man top up a compost heap. It's cold and it looks like rain, but I don't feel like going home yet. I want to sit and think about this new find, and let the fresh air free me of the shop's musty smell. What is it about old clothes that makes them smell like that? Even clean clothes seem to give off that sour smell after a time. It's the smell from the suitcase I remember most. Dad was the one who brought it home nearly 3 months after Suki disappeared, and about a week before my 15th birthday. I didn't recognize the case at first. Dad was crying when he handed it to me, and I could only look at him, feeling a falling in my chest like guilt or fear. The skin on his face was creased, and he made a dry sound in his throat. I'd never seen him cry before, and was too shocked to comfort him. He sat down on a chair by the stove and turned his face away. Ma didn't comfort him either. She just laid the suitcase on the kitchen table. Suki had got it for her honeymoon, a bulky thing made of brown leather with a brown leather handle and brass clasps. A point of pinkish light shone through the window, picking out the places on the clasps where the brass was scratched. I ran a finger over one, dulling the metal, and Ma brushed my hands away to open the case. That sour clothes smell filled the room, lying over the usual kitchen smells, fried onions and dried herbs and soap flakes, like a thick layer of dust. We stood and looked at Suki's things. The clothes were screwed together and twisted against the striped canvas lining. Blouses and pullovers and false fronts, a fur collar, and a pair of fawn trousers with tiny pleats on the waistband. Underneath was a dress, once beige, which Suki had only recently dyed a deep navy colour to make it new. And then there were the underclothes, knickers and camisoles, patched in silk and trimmed with lace. They weren't dirty, but the shine on the material was gone, as if they'd been handled by lots of people. "Oh dear, I can't think how you wash this," Ma said, taking out the dyed dress. "With cold water, perhaps. How much soap do you suppose, Maud?" I kept my eyes on the suitcase, wondering how long it was since Suki had touched the things inside. This was all we had left of her. I wanted to curl up in the case and shut the lid, not take everything out and wash her away. A blue glass bottle nestled against the sleeve of a blouse as if held in the crook of an arm. Suki's perfume. Evening in Paris. I pulled it free, automatically splashing my wrists and neck before I thought what I was doing. Ma stared at me through the haze of cheap, sweet scent, too light to linger long in the air, and then began to grab at the mass of cotton and jersey and wool as if she were kneading dough, battering the clothes against the sides of the case. Smaller things fell away, slipping onto the floor, and I was bundling up several pairs of silk drawers when Douglas came in.